Hello, everyone. What is up? Welcome back to another episode of Killer Instinct, you guys. Thank you so much for joining me here today. If you're new here, hi, my name is Savannah, and I am your host of Killer Instinct. Before we get started, make sure you go ahead and hit that subscribe button. That way you're never missing an episode. We post weekly here on the podcast every single Wednesday, and you are not going to want to miss it. We also upload the video version onto YouTube on Wednesdays as well, so make sure you are subscribed. Now, you guys, for today's case, as you know, it is April, and this is the month that is dedicated to serial killers. Now, this serial killer case is quite different than all of the others that we have done before. Reason being that the man that we are talking about today, John Brennan Crutchley, he is one who is believed to be a serial killer with well up to 30 victims. However, it was never proven and he was never charged with any of those crimes. I'm really interested to hear what you guys have to say about this today. I'm really interested to hear your thoughts, your feedback, what you think about this case as a whole, because I know for me personally, it was quite a wild ride doing this research. So I am very interested to hear what you guys have to say about it. So with that being said, let's jump right on into it today. So we're going to start this case off by jumping to November 22nd, 1985 in a town called Malabar, Florida. Malabar is a smaller county in Florida, being only 13 square miles. However, it is a beautiful place to live. And not only that, the crime rate in Malabar was extremely low at the time, with it being in the 95th percentile for being the safest city in Florida. So the crime rate was exceptionally low. But on November 22nd, 1985, the safe, idyllic community was shook to its core. On the night of November 22nd, 1985, there was a man who was driving down the road in Malabar, and he noticed off onto the side of the road a frightening sight. When he looked over, he saw that there was a woman who was crawling on the side of the road with both of her feet and hands bound. Now, the driver immediately pulled over to the side of the road where the woman was to see what was going on, and immediately once he got out of the car, he claimed that the woman became hysterical, she started crying, and was begging the driver not to take her back to that house. Now, the man ended up driving her back to her own home where the police and ambulance were called, and she was immediately taken to the hospital. Upon arriving to the hospital, the doctors discovered that she had been missing between 40 to 45% of her blood, and they also noticed ligature marks on her neck. Now, immediately upon arrival, the doctors began asking the victim what had happened. The victim identified herself as 19-year-old Laura Murphy. Laura was originally from California, however, she was in Florida on vacation visiting a friend of hers. She had been staying with this specific friend in his mobile home located at the Enchanted Lakes Mobile Homes in Malabar. During the day, her friend would leave her so he could go off to work, and then when he would come back, the two of them would be able to spend some time together and hang out. Now, November 21st, the day of November 21st, was no different. Her friend had gotten up, gotten ready for work, and left the house. Laura was at the mobile home by herself, and she started out watching some TV, just relaxing around the home, when she decided that she was going to take a walk over to the neighboring town of Melbourne, which was where some of her friends had also lived. The walk over to Melbourne wasn't very long, it was only several miles, and Laura wanted to go over there to see some of her friends because it was her last day on vacation and she wanted to give them a proper goodbye. So, with that being said, she got up, got dressed, she wore blue jeans and a black Harley Davidson t-shirt, and left the mobile home shortly after 1 p.m. on the 21st. Now, right as Laura began her walk, she claimed that it started to rain. What started out as a light drizzle quickly turned into a heavier rainfall with darker clouds and thunder moving in. Because of the change in weather, Laura claimed that she started picking up her pace a little bit and told herself that she would make a quick stop at the Jiffy Mart, which was right at the end of the street corner. It would give her a little bit of time to wait and see if the weather was going to pass. Now, right before she got to the Jiffy Mart, Laura claimed that this is when a car pulled up beside her. Now, inside of this car, Laura said, was a white man. He was clean shaven. He was wearing a dark sports coat and a black and white striped tie. The man appeared to be in his late 20s to early 30s. He had dark tinted sunglasses on and dirty blonde hair. Laura described him as being pale and thin and seemingly harmless. Laura claimed that the man rolled down the passenger side window and had made a joke to her about how this clearly wasn't the best day to be going for a walk, and also asked if he would like to give her a ride to wherever she was going. Laura claimed that she told the man that she was heading off to Melbourne, and if he was going that way, she would love a ride, but if it was going to be out of the way for him, it was no worries, and she would be able to make that walk on her own. Now, immediately without hesitation, the man told Laura that it was no problem at all because he was heading off to his office, which conveniently enough was in Melbourne as well. And the only thing he had to do was make a quick pit stop to his own house to grab his notebook. Now, Laura did claim that she was a little bit hesitant to get in this car. She wasn't sure if this was the right thing to do. However, with the pouring rain and the man who looked seemingly harmless, she decided to get into his car. Laura said that for the first few minutes of this drive, they made small talk, they just chit-chatted a little bit. She told him that she was visiting from out of state, and then about 5 minutes into the drive, the man turned down a dirt road and eventually into a driveway. The driveway led them to a red brick-style home, and Laura could remember that the home was very well kept, the landscaping was perfect, and the house was aligned with pine and oak trees. Once they got to the end of the driveway, the man looked at her and told her that he would be right back before getting out of the car and heading inside. Laura said that after a few minutes of the man being inside, he came out empty-handed. Laura said that this was a little bizarre because he made this whole ordeal about how he needed to go back to his house to get his notebook, but Laura said that once he left the house, the man was almost laughing to himself, and upon getting closer to the car, Laura could hear him make a joke about how the notebook must be in the car and not in the house after all. Laura claimed that the man got into the back seat of the car through the passenger side and started telling Laura that it had to be back there somewhere. Now, Laura said that she didn't think too much of this whole notebook ordeal and what was going on with that when he got into the backseat of the car, when all of a sudden and within a split second, Laura's seat was shot forward and her head was slammed into the dashboard. Then within a split second, she claimed that a rope was tied around her neck and the man was pulling tighter and tighter. Laura said that she did try and fight back by finding a bottle of Off bug spray that was in her purse, and she tried to spray the man behind her, but instead he yelled at her and said, "Stop or I'll kill you." Laura said that she remembers trying to fight back, trying to pull the rope off of her neck before ultimately she went unconscious. Now, Laura claims that she doesn't remember how long it took for her to regain that consciousness. However, when she did, she claimed that she realized that she had been moved. She was no longer in the front seat of that car. Laura claimed that when she came to, she realized that she was lying in the middle of a kitchen island. Her hands were tied over her head with rope, and her legs were bound at the other end of the island, and her legs were spread. Now, there were no lights on in this room that Laura was being kept in. However, there was one singular light bulb hanging from the middle of the ceiling, and Laura could also see a video camera mounted on a tripod standing in the middle of the room facing her. And Laura claims that she saw the red recording light blinking. Laura said that while she was taking in her surroundings and realizing what was going on, this is when the man reappeared over her, and this time he was wearing nothing. Laura claimed that when the man noticed that she saw the camera, he told her, quote, "That's to help me remember you, but don't worry, I keep them for myself," end quote. Laura then claimed that the man raped her several times while simultaneously choking her with a rope around her neck as she went in and out of consciousness. Once she came to again, she remembered the man grabbing duct tape and putting two pieces over her eyes. Now, shortly after this, Laura, who could not see anything at this point, then felt a sharp prick on her right arm. Now, again, she was not able to see what was going on because of the duct tape, so she really didn't know what was happening in this moment. But then after that first prick, there were then a few other pricks that followed in that same spot. She then felt the sharp pain again, but this time it was in her left arm. Then, after the sharp pricks, Laura claimed that she heard what sounded almost like a sucking noise. Now, again, she couldn't see what was happening, but because of that, her other senses were definitely heightened and she began feeling an odd sensation out of her right arm. She obviously knew that the man was doing something, but she couldn't figure out what that was. So she called out and asked what he was doing. And that is when he nonchalantly said back to her, quote, "I'm drinking your blood. I am a vampire," end quote. Shortly after drinking her blood, the man then handcuffed her again and placed her inside of his bathtub. He returned several hours later for his second round of raping her and the blood extraction. The next morning on November 22nd, the man went into the bathroom for a third time and raped and removed more blood from Laura. Now, at this time, the man looked at Laura and told her that he was running out for a few hours and that he would be back shortly. He also threatened Laura and told her not to leave this room or else his brother was going to kill her. Now, Laura did not let this threat stop her from trying to save her own life. Luckily, at this point, the duct tape was removed from her eyes, so she was able to see what was around her. And while she was sitting there, after she watched the man pull out of the driveway, she realized that the bathroom window was unlocked and she was able to open it up, jump out, and crawl onto the road where she was later rescued by that man who drove by. Now, police met Laura at the hospital where she recounted all of these events to the police, and this is when some alarms started ringing off in detectives' heads. Detectives remembered that there had been multiple complaints and some reports made from different sex workers in the area who claimed that they had been assaulted by an unknown male. One of these sex workers described how she met up with a man at the airport right outside of Malabar, and the man had attempted to choke her. Now again, Malabar was a low-crime area, it was a small town, so police immediately started to wonder if these two instances could be related. Now at first, when police were speaking to Laura, she did initially not want to press any charges because she was so petrified. She didn't want to have to see this man in trial. She didn't want to have to take the stand and testify against him. However, after some thought and after really talking to police more, Laura realized that she did not want anyone to have to go through the horror and the trauma that she had to endure. So she changed her mind. When the doctors examined Laura, they found that she did have puncture marks all over her arms and also on her right foot. She also had scratches on her wrists, ankles, legs, and stomach, and a rape kit was done that proved that she had been, in fact, sexually assaulted. However, there was no DNA left behind. Now, Laura spent the next 2 days in the hospital recovering from the 40% blood loss that she had endured, and then she was released. The doctors claimed that Laura had lost so much blood that if she had gotten to the hospital even just several hours later than she did, there is a very high probability that she would not have made it. Now, luckily, Laura did remember where she was being held captive. She remembered what the house looked like. She remembered what the driveway looked like. She remembered the route that she took after she got out of the driveway and ultimately was rescued. She remembered all of these things. So luckily, she was able to direct police back to the house where she was being held hostage. And on Saturday, November 23rd, 1985, that is when police arrested the man who kidnapped Laura. That was a man named John Brennan Crutchley. Imagine an app designed to make you use it less. Seems a little counterproductive, right? Well, Apartments.com's Instant Alert feature works exactly that way. Instead of scanning rental listings a million times a day, simply set and forget your search to whatever you're looking for in a place and let Apartments.com do the rest. From pet-friendly apartments to balconies to in-unit ACs, Apartments.com's powerful search tools let you know when the perfect combination of features you're seeking is listed, so you don't have to power through rental descriptions one by one. With more rental listings than anywhere else, Apartments.com Apartments.com's instant alerts mean that you can spend less time looking for the perfect place and more time on just doing you. Apartments.com, the place to find a place. John Crutchley was born on October 1st, 1946, in Clarksburg, West Virginia, to his parents, William and Mildred. His father was born in England and immigrated to the United States in 1914 and met Mildred, and the two got married in 1930. William worked for a natural gas company in Clarksburg, West Virginia, and he retired in 1969. John had an older brother named William Jr., and he also had an older sister named Donna June. Now, unfortunately, when Donna was 13 years old, she did end up passing away, and this was due to complications from a surgery that she had to have done. Doctors discovered that there was a glass tube inside of her. Now, obviously, this glass tube did have to be removed. However, she died during that surgery, and to this day, the details about what happened or why this glass tube was inside of her to begin with are very vague. However, what we do know is that Mildred, her mom, was very vocal about wanting another daughter after Donna had passed away. However, she got pregnant with John 2 years later. Now, obviously, John is a boy, and there was a lot of gender disappointment on Mildred's end when John was born. And again, she was very, very vocal about this, and it almost made her resent John even more. She had a lot of bitterness towards John in particular that she did not have for her other son, William Jr. Mildred's obsession with having a girl was really so prominent that for the first 5 years of John's life, Mildred raised him as a girl. She dressed him in all girls' clothing. She told people that he was a girl. And William, her husband, really didn't do any intervention on this. He didn't intervene on this at all. And even after he was 5 years old, John was still made to dress in girls' clothing. And it definitely caused him to have a lot of pent-up anger and confusion and animosity specifically towards his mom. Now, things did die down with John having to pretend to be a girl, and this was only because Mildred ended up getting pregnant again, and this time she was pregnant with a girl. But the anger that John had with his mom was everlasting. John definitely felt like the black sheep of the family. Both of his siblings would go on to be successful doctors and practice medicine. However, he always just felt like the odd guy out. But from the outside looking in, the Crutchleys seemed like a very close-knit family. John spent a lot of time during his upbringing trying to gain his mother's approval and gain affection from her. However, she just met him with more pushback and more bitterness. In fact, sometimes she became abusive towards John and would beat him. And again, it was only towards John that this behavior was being displayed. John also claimed that on multiple occasions, his mother physically beat him. One time he claimed that she beat him until he was unconscious with a belt. There was another instance where he claimed that she purposely burnt his fingers with a curling iron. But again, none of this other abusive behavior was being shown towards his other siblings. Now, John did do relatively well in school, but only when it came to subjects that he cared about. John very much liked math, he liked science, and he had straight A's there. The thing about John is that he was incredibly intelligent. He was incredibly smart. His IQ was actually 168, which puts him in the same category as Albert Einstein. So he was incredibly intelligent, but that intelligence would really only shine through in the subjects that he cared about. So again, the maths, the sciences, he really enjoyed those, but all of the other categories like history or art, he really did not care about, and it would cause him to just completely fail altogether. And while he did have a lot of the book smarts that he needed to get by in school, one thing that he did lack was the street smarts and the social skills. John had a lot of social anxiety. He became very nervous around people. And John even said that because of his social anxiety, it really caused him to become a bully in school. John himself claimed that he became a bully simply because it came more natural to him than just normal social skills. He also said that he had a very hard time around girls. He was very nervous when it came to being around girls, and he didn't know how to approach them at all. So really, his solution to that was just to avoid them altogether. Now, John graduated from high school and then went on on to attend Defiance College, which was located in Ohio. Now, this again was really the only school and the only college that he could get into because his grades were so poor. And while he was at Defiance College, it was there that his classmates voted him most likely to self-destruct. Now, in 1967, John was placed on academic suspension after getting a 1.4 grade point average, and that is when he transferred to Point Park College. While at Point Park, he met a woman who would later become his first wife, and this woman was named Maud. Now, after getting married, the two moved in together into a trailer into Defiance. While they were married, it was said that John spoke very, very poorly about Maud in front of other people. He very much would just bash her and belittle her and put her down. Whenever he was around his coworkers, he would say things like, quote, "This is Maud. Don't pay any attention to her. She's a sex maniac," end quote. And it's probably because of that that it's not a huge surprise when I tell you that in 1973, Maud filed for divorce, and this is when John moved to Indiana for a new job. Now, Maud described her marriage to John, and just John in particular, as being crazy and capable of anything. She also said, quote, "I was afraid of him for 4 years. When I filed for divorce, he threw me on the floor, tried to strangle me, and threatened to kill me," end quote. She also claimed that John had violent behavior and random outbursts. She claimed that after they got married, John started shoplifting. This was just a hobby that he developed, and it wasn't because he needed things and could not afford them, but it was simply because he wanted the thrill. He was looking for that adrenaline rush, and shoplifting gave him that. Now, when it came to John's childhood, Maud also claimed that John had confided in her about something that had been going on during his childhood, which was the fact that he had been having a sexual relationship with his younger sister Carolyn for years. John claimed that him and his sister had sex the night that he graduated from high school, and that the incest lasted for years after that. Now, after divorcing Maud, John continued to have many romantic and sexual partners. And when it came to women in general, it was said that whenever John would hyperfixate on one woman, he had to have her in that moment no matter what. He could not handle rejection or lack of reciprocation. And over time, John ended up keeping an index card file, and on each index card would be every woman that he would have sex with. But not only that, it would contain all personal information that he knew about them, and was also rating their sexual performance on these cards as well. Now, on January 6th, 1978, John began dating a new woman named Debbie Fitzjohn, but after several weeks of dating, Debbie disappeared. A few months after Debbie went missing, John had a new fixation, a woman named Patricia Hoffer. John was writing Patricia many, many letters. He said things like, quote, "I want you more than anyone or anything else in the world, and my stupid head is driving me nuts. Please call. You'll always be a rare first-class person in my mind, and so far, the only one that I've ever dreamed of having a child with," end quote. Several years after Patricia in 1980, John met his second wife, a woman named Karen, and the two ended up having a son together in late 1981. By 1983, John and his family moved to Malabar, Florida, where he began working for a company as an engineer. So now, let's get back into the investigation after police had arrested John. After arresting John, police brought him down to the police station, and this is when John was actually very willing and eager to talk to police because he wanted to get across what he said was his side of the story. Now, when it came to John's side of the story, he claimed that everything that happened between him and Laura was consensual. He claimed that Laura told him about a fantasy that she had, which was a fantasy to struggle. He also claimed that Laura told him that she had a dream of sleeping with Charles Manson. Now, John claimed that because his wife was out of town and because the two were going through some marital issues, John just needed to take the edge off, and he needed some time away from his wife. When it came to drinking her blood, John did admit that this was his idea, but claimed that he had been drinking his wife's blood hundreds of times before and had also taken blood from his previous girlfriends, so he just figured it was a normal practice to do. Now, at this point, police did get a warrant to search through John's home, and upon doing so, they found multiple videotapes, rope, surgical tubing, a beaker, needles, and syringes. They also found leather dog collars in the master bedroom closet, despite not having any dogs in the house. They recovered a gun. There were also chains and several plastic bags containing hair clippings and a small piece of weed. Now, when it came to the videotape of Laura that John had taken during her rape, that videotape had been erased after John had realized that Laura had escaped. So during that short period of time, John had gone back through the video camera and deleted that specific tape. Now, throughout the house, police also discovered the ID of John's ex-wife, Maude, and another ex-girlfriend. Police also found a book called The Killer Clown, which was a biography of the serial killer, John Wayne Gacy. There were also about 20 pieces of jewelry that were found, and this jewelry was not anywhere near where John's wife, Karen, kept hers, so police found that to be a bit odd and wondered if this could be a trophy collection. Police also searched John's car and noticed that he had installed a button right next to the steering wheel of the car that allowed him to lock the passenger side door, which would restrict other people from getting out of the vehicle. Now, police also got a warrant to search through John's office at his work. They were able to go there, search through his desk and through his belongings, and when doing so, they discovered a plastic bag, and inside of this plastic bag was upwards near 60 different IDs of women. One of these women was a woman named Patty Volansky. Patty had gone missing in March 1985. John also had her social security card, her library card, her voter registration card, and pictures of her children as well. In John's filing cabinet, police discovered a yellow box that was filled with 70 photographs of women who were bound and gagged. In several of the pictures, you can see a man's hand around the woman's neck, and it was in the same filing cabinet that investigators discovered the index card box that contained 72 index cards, and each card had the name of a woman, her address, phone number, her astrological sign, and how John had met them. Debbie Fitzjohn had an index card, and again, this was the woman that John dated and then disappeared. And at the bottom of her card, it said, "Disappeared, 27 Jan, 78. Now, police knew very quickly upon seeing all of these things, the mountain of identification cards, as well as the index cards, they believed without a shadow of a doubt that they were dealing with not only a repeat offender, but a serial killer. They believed that Debbie was one of John's very first victims. On the night that Debbie went missing, she went over to John's house in Fairfax. She left her house at approximately 7:30 p.m. and never returned home. Now, the following morning, John had gotten to his car and skipped town, and when Debbie never returned home the following day, her mother filed a missing persons report. When police spoke to John about Debbie, he had written up an entire timeline about the day of the 27th of January. It almost seemed to police like John was trying to cover his tracks. Now, John also took a polygraph test in regards to Debbie's disappearance, and he failed miserably. Now, several months after her disappearance, on October 15th, there were three hunters who came across a human skull in the woods in Fairfax County. Now, forensics were able to determine that the remains did in fact belong to 25-year-old Debbie, and the cause of death was suggested to be strangulation. Now, regardless of all of this, there was not enough physical evidence to take this case to trial, so ultimately, the case went cold and John was never charged with Debbie's murder. Now, there are several other unsolved cases that police believe that John is responsible for, one of which is the murder of 15-year-old Kathy Kathy Lynn Beatty in Montgomery, Maryland. Kathy was beaten to death and sexually assaulted on July 24th, 1975. She ended up remaining in a coma for a month before she sadly passed away. Now, another ID that was found in John's work desk was the ID of 25-year-old Nancy K. Brown, who went missing while she was vacationing in Cocoa Beach, Florida on June 6th, 1983. Her remains were discovered the following year, and it was determined that she died from blunt force trauma to the head. 2 months after Nancy's body was discovered, police also found the body of 16-year-old Cheryl Windsor, who went missing the month prior. It was believed that John was guilty of this murder as well because he lived nearby at the time, and that is what police were realizing was the pattern here. John had a tendency to move around from place to place. He lived in Indiana for a short period of time. He did live in Maryland. He lived in Ohio. And there were a lot of unsolved murders that were happening around the times that he lived there. And police believed that he ended up just getting off of these murders because he would end up moving to a different state. Now, in 1985, the remains of a 21-year-old woman named Kim Walker were found in Malabar, Florida. Now, the cause of death of Kim was unknown, but she was last seen getting into a car that was very similar to John's car in June 1984. Now, this same year is when the remains of 40-year-old Lynn DeSantis were discovered in Grant, Florida. She was last seen hitchhiking outside of a motel in Melbourne, Florida, and both IDs that belonged to Kim and Lynn were found in John's desk. Now, police also learned about two other unsolved murders that occurred in the early 1980s. The murders occurred at the Naval Station, and this is when John was working for a company called TRW, which had direct ties to the Naval Station and the Pentagon. Now, one of the victims of these murders was a woman named Pamela Kimbier. She was 23 years old and went missing on March 25th, 1982. She was found the next day tied to the back seat of her own car. She had been raped and strangled. Now, 10 months later, 21-year-old Carol Molnar disappeared from a nightclub, and her body was discovered underneath the rocks by the ocean near the naval station. Now, at the time of their deaths, both Carol and Pamela were carrying microfilm with classified images, and those images that they were carrying were later found at John's house. But again, there was just not enough physical evidence to tie him to these murders. Now, despite all of this, despite all the IDs being found, despite John being tied to all of these unsolved murders, John was only charged with the offense and the attack on Laura. He was charged with sexual battery, aggravated battery, kidnapping, possession of marijuana, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Now, when the news of John's arrest went public, the community was shocked. Neighbors described him as a nice person and a quiet neighbor, but a forensic psychiatrist said that those qualities are what make John the most dangerous. The forensic psychologist said, quote, "The most frightening thing about John is that he gives off no signals that would alarm you. You would never see him coming. He could pass as anybody. He seems normal. There's nothing about him that would lead you to believe that he is anything other than an engineer," end quote. And that was really what was shocking to everyone in regards to John. Everyone who knew John, again, said he was just quiet. He kept to himself. He was very nice. But after learning about the details of what he did to Laura, he was quickly coined the vampire rapist. So instead of being the nice, quiet engineer, he was now the vampire rapist. Now, several days after John was arrested, he ended up getting released on bail. And during the time that he was released, he did try and cover his tracks. While police had originally searched through John's home, they were taking pictures, one of which was of John's safe. Now, the warrant that police had did not cover what was inside of the safe. So police could not take anything out of it, but they were able to take pictures of what was inside of it. Now, when police looked at what was inside of the safe, they were able to see that there were 20 credit cards in that safe. And after John was released from bail, all of those credit cards that were in the safe mysteriously seemed to vanish. Now, in 1986, John did end up pleading guilty on the kidnapping and rape charge in exchange for the prosecutors to drop the bodily harm charge for when he drank Laura's blood. So he was sentenced to prison in 1968. Now, if you're wondering what John's wife thought about all of this, Karen actually stood by John throughout everything and told reporters she was adamant that John was not guilty and that he was just quote unquote a kinky sort of guy. Now, regardless of that, the judge ended up giving John a 25-year to life prison sentence with 50 years of parole once he was to be released. And if you're sitting here thinking that is not nearly enough, well, John did not even serve that amount of time. After 11 years of his sentence, John was released on August 8th, 1996 for good behavior. After his release, he was sent to the Orlando Probation and Rehabilitation Center, which was a halfway house where he would be finishing out the 50 years of his parole. Now, after just one day of being released, just one day that John was released, John ended up violating his parole order and he ended up being tested positive for marijuana. One of the rules that John had was that he was not able to get involved in any sort of drugs. He could not take drugs, he could not be around drugs. And now, just one day after his release, he is being tested positive for marijuana. So because of this, John was arrested again. And even though he denied it, he denied that he had ever smoked any sort of weed, this offense actually costed him life in prison without the possibility of parole. And if you're sitting here wondering why, it was because of the three strikes law. John had already been convicted of kidnapping and rape, and so because this was his third offense, he was now being sentenced to life in prison. And that began on January 31st, 1997. Now, after John had been in prison for several years, on March 30th, 2002, he was found dead in his jail cell with a plastic bag over his head, and the cause of death was asphyxiation. Now, the Florida Department of Corrections did declare that the asphyxiation was self-inflicted and was done as an erotic act. It's called autoerotic asphyxiation, and this is the act of asphyxiation for the purpose of sexual gratification. So it is believed that John was not in fact trying to take his own life during this act, but simply was trying to get some sort of sexual fulfillment from it. However, instead, he ended up taking his life, which if you look at the pattern of John's offenses and his attacks on other women, all of the unsolved murders that he's believed to be tied to, it is quite ironic that that would be the way that he would end his life. Now that, you guys, is the case of John Brennan Crutchley. I am very curious, like I said in the beginning, to see what you have to say about all of this. Do you think that John is this master manipulator, serial killer that the police and the public have coined him out to be? This vampire rapist, vampire killer. Do you believe that he's tied to all of these unsolved cases? Do you believe that he should have been put away far before he ever was? Let me know in the comments below what you think about this case. And with that being said, you guys, that is all for me today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode of Killer Instinct. Again, if you're new here, hi, my name is Savannah. I'm your host of Killer Instinct. Make sure you go ahead and hit the subscribe button. That way you never miss an episode. We post weekly here on the podcast every single Wednesday. You're not going to want to miss it. I'll be back next week with a brand new one for you guys. And until then, stay safe. Bye, guys.